Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the darkened corridors of power and we shine a light ahead of us on the path to where evolution is taking us. And we have a very evolutionary conversation today. The purpose of our Wiki Politiki podcast is to bring left and right front and center, to face the music and dance together, to address problems rather than defend positions. We have another purpose as well, and that is to provide context at a time when the content can be contradictory, confusing, and overwhelming. Now, today we're going to focus on what I call the missing piece, and that can also be spelled P-E-A-C-E, at the center of our public life, our culture, and our politics, the sacred. We can see from our current new word situation that the truth isn't sacred, that the web of life isn't sacred, and treating others the way we wish to be treated, that's not sacred either in our current political climate. It seems as if money and power have replaced everything we used to consider most valuable in life, at least on the surface. However, there are so many things happening. The imaginal cells are connecting together even as the caterpillar debris falls all around us. Our guest today is Stephen Dynan. He's written a book, Sacred America, Sacred World, Fulfilling Our Mission in Service to All. We're going to talk about how this seemingly abstract idea of sacred can and will have a huge impact on our nation's purpose, destiny, and current challenges. Stephen Dynan is the CEO of the Shift Network, an online educational platform that delivers virtual summits and courses and trainings in domains as diverse as spirituality, peace, holistic health, psychology, parenting, enlightened business, shamanism, indigenous wisdom, and sustainability. That's a big order. All of those are related to our conversation today. Stephen is also a graduate of Stanford University and the California Institute of Integral Studies. He was director of membership and marketing at the Institute of Noetic Sciences prior to founding the Shift Network. Welcome, Stephen.
Thanks for having me, Steve. Love the intro and context you set for this show.
Good. And I know we're really going to, it's going to be a rich conversation. So let's begin with your idea, Sacred America, Sacred World. What prompted you to write that book, and how can it make a difference in what seems to be a very profane political climate?
Well, what I believe is that when we see something as, you know, as essentially not sacred, we're not going to bring our best to it. And so if we assume that the political realm is off limits for any talk of the deeper dimension, heart and soul of life, then we're going to behave in a way that's much less evolved. And so at the heart of the book is really a recognition that we need to shift to really seeing our country through the eyes of a sacred lens, where we extend this sense of sacred beyond just our family or our religion or our tribe, to really seeing all of humanity and ultimately the earth as a whole as something that we've been entrusted with, as sort of a sacred gift, if you will. So when we relate to something in a sacred way, it's more of a heart relationship. It's more there's an energy of respect and reverence in it. And when we relate to our country that way, we have we see it with through different eyes. Instead of being on the left, people tend to be more jaded or cynical and always, you know, assuming the worst of our larger motivations and being kind of jaded about what America represents. And on the right, it can be kind of like undyingly loyal, but in a way that doesn't actually allow for the critiques and the self-reflection that's necessary for growth. So I think the sacred and the deepest love means that we have a love for our country, but it's not a love that's static. It's a dynamic love that wants us to grow and fulfill a higher version of ourselves. It's a love that matures us. And ultimately, it moves not just towards America, but towards the world as a whole. That's why it's Sacred America, Sacred World. It's about bridging from where we are, which is more nation-centric, into where we're going, which is to be more globally centric, and that America has a role in pioneering this pathway and to demonstrate this. Now, it may not look like that on the surface because of a lot of what's been going down in terms of nationalism, rise of xenophobia, and the, you know, anti-immigrant bias. But in many ways, those are sort of like the exaggerated version of what we're outgrowing, and ultimately, I think, part of the process of maturing into this new phase. So ultimately, when we hold something as sacred, we act with more respect and reverence. And when we do that, we also start to create deeper bridges between left and right. It was interesting just this last weekend, there was an article circulating about how a couple of guys at a Trump rally had a T-shirt that said, "I'd rather be Russian than a Democrat." And I thought it was, there was a lot of outrage about it, but I thought it was interesting to, in just terms of illuminating, when you're in this like polarized warfare psychology, how you become so filled with hatred and separation that you're certainly not acting with respect and reverence for the other side, but you become identified with you know, whoever is the enemy of your enemy becomes your friend. And so there's this way in which we've kind of been stuck in this heightened polarization, which you speak to really beautifully in the reason for this show. And then we get the outpicturing of that, which is a very non-sacred public discourse, rather than our public discourse and our policy making being an expression of the highest and best in us.
You know, part of that, of course, has been the missing piece. Another missing piece in government of the people has been the people. And it seems that the narratives on both sides, there was an excellent book, I think you've probably seen it, called Wedged by Eric Fogg, which talks about how wedge issues tend to increase the polarization because each party is looking to get the support of their side by gathering them around the most, by making them angry and afraid. And so the exact opposite of making people angry and afraid through organizations and processes like, for example, living room conversations, which actually allow people to rehumanize in response to the dehumanization that's taking place. So as we unfold our conversation, we do have an extremely polarized situation right now. And in fact, so much of the conversation is about Trump and anti-Trump that it's almost taken the oxygen out of the proverbial room in regards to anything else. How can we get a hearing for something as, let's say, transformational and this meta context of all of us being in this together, even if we disagree? What do we do over this next period of time to help people be able to see that and experience it?
Well, I kind of see that we're on this arc where we're experiencing the most exaggerated form of the partisan warfare, and that it's headed for a kind of a pop or an implosion, if you will. And that you know, I think with the Mueller investigation proceeding, we're going to hit a point fairly soon of incontrovertible evidence that leads to a fall from grace of Trump. And then that, I think, in the aftermath of that is what we need to be planning for. I mean, we plan, first of all, by doing the deep work in our hearts and souls and with other people so that we are actually not seeing if we're progressive, we're not seeing conservatives as the enemy, or somehow in a less respectful way. Is it like we actually need to take them seriously and honor them and their needs and their desires and their values, and that's a process that has to happen one on one or in small groups, living room groups. There's this rehumanization process you speak to, so that's a process we can do, you know, in our inner landscape. You know, it's like, for instance, you know, when I was super polarized against Sarah Palin, I actually read both of her books, and that was an exercise for me in being able to see the world through her eyes, and it helped to kind of reduce some of the warfare charge that was running in my psyche. So you can do that by reading things, you can do that by making personal bridges and connections, and having deeper dialogues, like Living Room Conversations advocates. But then ultimately, I think that there has to be a culturally ripe moment for these things to become more front and center, when we recognize just how dysfunctional the warfare psychology has become. And I think we're going to have that opportunity fairly soon, which is why I'm starting to lay groundwork and think about assuming there is a kind of implosion of the Trump administration, how does this not just be about a swing left-right, but actually a transformational movement upward for America, so that we move beyond some of the warfare psychology in our politics to a mutual commitment to the higher ideals, to real solutions that bridge divides, to really being one America. And that's, you know, at the heart of my book, a lot of what I was writing about there. And I think that we're going to be reaching a kind of a cultural zeitgeist in which these solutions are going to become more needed and therefore more prominent in the media and other places.
You know, your background has been in integral philosophy. And after the election, I think in January of last year, Ken Wilber came out with a piece that was really a critique of how the progressives have progressed or not progressed over the past generation or two. I know you're familiar with that. How do you see that? Because again, we tend to look at the right wing as they're more narrow-minded, they're more rigid, and so on. And yet, there are things such as political correctness and some of these other and identity politics that has really created or accentuated separations. How do you look to integrate this integral idea into your new work?
Yeah, well, I think that the basic premise is that if you act with disrespect or dishonor towards somebody, you're going to get a worse result over time. And so even though a lot of the progressive ideas are in many ways a developmental advance, if you then diminish and demean the people who are holding the previous value system, that's ultimately going to create some backlash. And so you basically, from Ken's perspective, you have the green meme that's evolving more world in all-inclusive, you know, taking into account a lot of other views, but then going to war with the blue meme, which is the more traditional meme. And so that more traditional value set then starts to turn and go to battle. And so the real call is to like not become so identified in our positions that we can't actually meet the other and honor them. So in my book, I write about, you know, write about how we actually need to become really deeply honoring of the more traditional conservative mindset and values, and how important a role it plays in society in creating a healthy, strong foundation for further growth, if you will. That sort of, you know, deep goodness and loyalty to community and country and often religious system, that creates a kind of a solidity and a grounding for a culture to evolve still further. We don't want to undermine that, because it can undermine, you can end up with a lot of chaos and dysfunction. And that's why they're always wanting to protect the family, for instance, because it's like there's a sense of creating a safe container for us to grow up in is part of what the blue meme does really well. And so if they're denigrated or undermined for holding those value systems, it ultimately undermines the growth of a still more mature country. So you have to kind of like, you have to see that there's a way in which the more conservative forces hold this homeostasis, if you will, for an organism. So if you think of America as an organism, as I know you and Bruce do, it's like there's a positive homeostasis that allows us to protect all of the systems that we have. And a lot of times we're trying to change those systems really fast. So evolution is happening much faster. And so if we undermine the forces that are helping to stabilize things and hold it together and maintain institutions and traditions, then that can ultimately lead to devolution rather than evolution. So that's part of how on the progressive side. And so I think what Ken did was, I would probably go a little bit, I wouldn't go as far as him, because in a way he put most of the blame for the emergence of Trump on the forces of the mean green meme, as he likes to call it, which I think is an overshoot, because there's a lot of other forces at play in this too. But I think that taking responsibility for some causative role of like, oh wow, it's our own nastiness that has led to the emergence of the lack of real care for people who are in rural communities or who are feeling left behind in different ways, that there's a way in which it's created the backlash effect that Trump is the tip of the spear of in many ways.
Yeah, and you know, of course, there are a lot of people who are just totally shocked by the election of Trump and couldn't quite understand how people could even imagine voting for him. And I think that on the progressive side over the years, there's been kind of a arrogance and looking down the nose at, those white working class people. And paradoxically or ironically, the left tends to uphold the underdog, and they tend to uphold those people who've had breaks against them, and yet the white man and poor white working class has been an ignored group. Michael Moore pointed that out really well. So when we come back, I want to talk a little bit. We have a little break coming up. I want to talk more about how we deal with the current situation, which is so polarized that people seem to be living in different realities, and that the Republican Party has become a bit of a cult. We'll be back with Stephen Dynan. He's the author of Sacred America, Sacred World, right after this break.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years, delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
I am Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called the Bukavu in the Congo. We were a loving family, and then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day. People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle to America, and all your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything. I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at EmbraceRefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Steve Behrman. I'm back with my guest, Stephen Dynan. He is the president, CEO of Shift Network and the author of Sacred America, Sacred World. Before the break, I mentioned the idea that, you know, we're living in a very, very strange and unusual time in this country. People have compared the upcoming constitutional crisis with Trump as these revelations get revealed to the Richard Nixon presidency and impeachment. And one thing that I see as a very stark difference is that those people who have and I'm offering my prejudice here and my perspective. Those people who have drunk the Donald Trump Kool-Aid that ain't that cool. You know, they seem to be it just seems to be a cult, and it doesn't matter what Donald Trump does or does not do. That core group, it probably varies between 25% and 35% of the electorate, will stick with him no matter what he does. And the whole idea of fake news. I mean, with those people, when Donald Trump says that the New York Times and Washington Post are fake news, the people on his side believe that. They take that to heart. How does one work with that level of I'd call it beyond polarity. It's like living in alternative realities. How do we bridge the gap between those realities right now?
Yeah, I'm not sure we can fully bridge the gap in any sort of collective way at the moment until more like Mueller's report comes out or some more dramatic things come out, because in a way part of the you know, we talked a little bit about the blue meme and the you know, green meme from the developmental standpoint. So the traditionalist mindset is very focused on loyalty to a hierarchical leadership pattern. So that takes the form of loyalty to biblical truth and in religious format, and it can take the form of like very fierce loyalty to a leader in a situation. So you basically have a situation where we've created cycle after cycle of increased warfare left and right. And so then what do you want to do? You want to elect the toughest leader who's going to fight for your side or fight for yourself. And then you're going to become incredibly loyal to that leader and basically avoid any extraneous information that might challenge your view, because your literal life depends on that loyalty to the leader. So that fierce loyalty to the leader is kind of baked in more to the blue value system than it is on the left. So the left has a hard time understanding that. But so what you end up with is this kind of cultishness, and Trump is somebody who really knows how to play that. He has been very focused on essentially a kind of a collective entrancement with his ideas. Like he does it with emotional. It's like you're getting this rush of new excitement. He challenges. He voices things that people might think, but that they've been afraid to say. And so they get really fixated on him. And then he reinforces that the media is the enemy of the people. And so he has a lot of the dynamics that have really fed into leaders like, you know, historical real bad guys who are able to manipulate that. I don't think we're going to get to the point where he becomes a threat of that being the whole country, because his popularity is too low for that. But there is a really serious question about how do you shift that relationship with his people. So I think it's going to take the form of a fairly dramatic fall from grace at some point, because that system is built around the loyalty to the leader. So it'll have to be an emergence of something, a collusion tape, something that is like incontrovertible proof that sort of shocks the system and leads to a lot of leaders who have previously supported him bolting, and then the sense of like, oh, that he's not who we have projected him to be, which there's also some very strong literal, you know, kind of projections of him being a kind of messianic figure or fulfilling biblical prophecy that have gotten woven into this. So we're going to hit some point, which I liken it to the Harvey Weinstein moment, where people in Hollywood thought, oh, Harvey's far too powerful to ever fall, and he had too many people who were vested in his success. But at a certain point, once it crossed a certain threshold, it was just a rapid decline. So I feel like that's going to happen with Trump at some point when the evidence gets strong enough or something that's a shock to the system comes out.
And then the people who are really going to turn on Trump are going to be the ones who have been so entranced with him, because there's nothing like waking up from a cultish devotion that turns people into really rabidly opposed and attacking. And so I think that ultimately my projection is that ultimately the people who will impeach him or remove him from office are going to be the Republicans who turn on him in a certain moment once a critical mass is reached. Because I think the loyalty isn't as much to Trump as it is to the idea of Trump in a way. And if it becomes fully revealed that he's not who – that he has essentially conned people into thinking he is this – figure that's a redemptive figure for a certain population, then they will turn really fast, because they don't have actually the long-term personal loyalty that comes from like a religious attachment, for instance.
Yeah, and I know that's even though when you look at Trump with the sound off, his gesticulations look an awful lot like Adolf Hitler. The situation is not quite the same in that there's not a uniform population of people large enough to sustain the movement and to keep up that pretense. At the same time, it's also important to recognize that the Republican Party hierarchy and establishment, in a certain way, certain aspects of that, are getting their agenda met. First of all, certainly the religious right seems to be getting their agenda addressed. And then the other thing is that that's one of Trump's insurance policies. Another of his insurance policies is the Israeli right wing. And it's funny how so many of the Alex Joneses and all of those people, they tend to be borderline anti-Semitic, certainly anti-Zionist. And so they were applauding Trump for not supporting this global Zionist agenda. And here Trump is essentially in bed with the Israeli right wing. So what that does, however, should he get as far as 2020, is that in that regard, he will have the support of AIPAC, the very pro-Israel kind of right-wing American, very powerful lobby. So I think it's also important to see that the people who have benefited from Trump's presidency right now have some investment in it.
I think there's a truth in that, and I think it comes back to what we were saying before, is that if you're in the state of like seeing everything through the lens of enemies, and Democrats or liberals or progressives are the enemy, then if you focus enough of your attention on that, then you can make alliances with a bunch of people who feel like, oh, the Democrats or liberals or progressives are the enemy for some reason or another. And so he's actually stitched together a lot of people who want to have that sense of shared enemy. But they actually don't even agree on a lot of the basic foundational concepts. So it's more like this sense of focusing attention on who you dislike rather than what you're actually trying to create.
Exactly, and there is that biblical saying where there's no vision, the people perish. And one of the, to me anyway, one of the reasons why Trumpism has taken hold is that there's a certain coherence to that vision. People hold it very, very strongly. And even though it's really maybe one quarter of the people in this country hold that, they're holding it so strongly and they're so so enrolled and so convinced that becomes a dominant theme and meme. What has been missing, and hopefully we're going to address that in the rest of this conversation, what has been missing and why our country is so disheartened is that at the heart of things, we've kind of lost our center, we've lost our direction, we've lost our essentially lost our heart and soul of who we really are. And so the Democrats have, unfortunately, until now, not really been able to hold a coherent, compelling vision for the future. It's basically been vote for us, we're not as bad as the other guys. Say more about how we cultivate this vision for the future, and we'll talk a little bit more about the work that you're doing to bring that forward.
Well, I think, first of all, we have to look beyond election cycles. We have to really sort of, we have to look into, like, what is the deep future that we want to create? What is the legacy for our children and grandchildren? And I think that, you know, we find common ground in, like, America being a really shining light unto the world, a place where liberty and equality and justice for all are really foundational principles, that we're not a corrupt kleptocracy like, you know, some other countries out there, that we are actually leading the way in terms of innovation, economic innovation, that we are successful in a multiple levels in really creating a peaceful, prosperous world. And that's so I think we need to up-level our vision. So right now we're a little focused on the power drives, like being dominant over others, being the dominant economy, dominant military force. And I think we need to up-level those commitments to, you know, America being the greatest peace-building nation on the planet, the greatest pioneer in sustainability, but the greatest advocate for true health and human thriving. And that comes from demonstrating that internally. It comes from, like, really having a country that isn't just wealthy for a few, but that is actually broadly, that there's a broadening of the wealth and that there's an uplifting of the poor and a elimination of some of the forces of discrimination that have really poisoned different relationships in our country. So we have to be rigorous about our own shadow work. We have to say, okay, there are many areas where we're lagging badly. We've been sliding down even the scales of rating democracies to we're now a flawed democracy rather than a full democracy. So there's some really deep reforms around getting the big corporate money out of politics. And there's some real shared common ground in that, because whether you're left or right, the idea of like a handful of people and corporations basically dictating many of the policies of our country, that's problematic for just about anybody. And so there's some real common ground about how do we reform our democracy? We have a healthy, thriving democracy. How do we reduce the influence of partisanship in whether, you know, whether our vote even counts? So there's some shared common ground there, and also a shared vision of just, what does it look like when America's truly successful, that we have a vibrant, humming economy, that we are actually leading the way in living sustainably? That's something that, even though there's been a reaction on the right, if you pair the impulse towards sustainability with economic growth, like we can lead the way in solarization, we can lead the way in electric cars. These are things where you can pair growth with addressing environmental concerns as well, and that's where you can find a lot of shared common ground with people who I still think of my father-in-law was a very hardcore Republican, and he loved the book Natural Capitalism by Amory Lovins, because he was like, oh, now I see how I can make some money off this field. And so there's a way in which if we propose things not just out of our own value system, but understanding the value system of the other and how some of the solutions that we need and the things that we need to grow as a country are actually fulfillments of both left and right values. But if you only express them as left values, then you don't get anywhere. I think of, like, Van Jones a number of years ago wrote an article for Forbes or Fortune about criminal justice reform and reforming of prisons, and basically made the argument almost entirely from right-wing values. And over time, he's helped to broker a lot of relationships and deals that led to people like Newt Gingrich getting behind criminal justice reform, or Grover Norquist, and realizing that, you know, burgeoning prison populations was very expensive and actually creating career criminals more than it was actually creating the changes that a lot of people on the right were wanting to see. And so from a more economic standpoint, it's like reducing prison populations makes a lot of sense. And so I think that's where we have to kind of, you know, bracket our own values, be able to step into the shoes of the other, and show how a vision of the future can look. Now, I outlined quite a number of things in my book, and I was proud that there was a number of prominent Republicans who actually endorsed my book, like Rich Toffel, who's the founder of the Log Cabin Republicans. Mm-hmm. And Doesn't mean they agreed with every single position, but they could see them. They could see a future that they could both agree on, or that they could agree on as well. And I had people who have told me that they read the book and gave it to the like a progressive person, and then gave it to a conservative family member, and that they both agreed that they really like found value in the book, because I was trying to point the way. Now, I'm not the only one doing this, but the point is it's possible, and we just don't think it's possible because we're kind of stuck in our own warring value camps, rather than saying, okay, what's a vision that we can align behind of what is a peaceful and prosperous and successful country look like?
Well, as I was saying to you earlier backstage, the original title for the book that I wrote with Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution, was The American Evolution, because we recognized, going back to that aspect of the traditional values, the vibration that our founders had, both from their adoption of Iroquois Confederacy, Native peoples' sense of democracy and sacred circle, and also through certainly Franklin, Jefferson, Washington, being influenced by perennial wisdom, by the Masons, by the Rosicrucians even. So we have a universalist, very evolved vibration at the center of what we're doing. And, you know, it's occurred to me that successful businesses have mission statements, and individuals who want to be successful and they're looking to survive, thrive in a certain sphere, they will write their mission and vision statements and so on. And as you suggested earlier, what an opportunity we have now to actually collectively come together and come up with a forward-moving vision statement and mission statement for our country, not as a cliche, but as something that genuinely informs what we have. So how do we begin to have these conversations on a national level where they move the dial and more people can recognize that these are the generative conversations in our in creating a future, and these other polarizing conversations might be weapons of mass distraction?
Well, I know we have a break coming up, so I'll just a succinct answer from my perspective is that we actually dig into the history and find those places that are a shared lineage of understanding that haven't been polarized left and right. So I think that the values of liberty, equality, and justice for all are sort of my candidates for three of the kind of unifying things. If you've got, you know, got freedom and equality and justice for all, that really thread throughout our entire history as like unifying American values, like that tells a lot, and that creates a powerful foundation. And I personally like the motto of E Pluribus Unum, because it means out of many one. It's pointing us towards oneness, towards our deeper unity, and actually even a higher mission of, I would say, even unifying the planet, that we can create this unified human family, and that we're demonstrating that in our country first. And I think that E Pluribus Unum is a good candidate for a motto or a mission for us. And I think we don't have to create the new. We have to touch into what we've inherited and find that common ground and articulate our beliefs and our dreams and our visions from those standpoints.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Barry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network, presenting transformative programs and events to help you waken to your full potential so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the Wiki Politiki sponsors page.
My name is Meera Batra, and this is How I Live United. Many families have come to America for a better life. I advocate for these families with United Way. United Way empowers them to see opportunities available. We help them get involved with their kids, schools, and network within the community. My name is Meera Batra. I help families see opportunity and succeed. I don't just wear the shirt. I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live united. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Steve Behrman. We're back with Stephen Dynan talking about sacred America and sacred world. I really appreciate that phrase that you use, Stephen, shared lineage of understanding. And when I work with Joseph McCormick on the Reuniting America book and project, that's really what we were looking at. Even though we came from very, very different political viewpoints, we were really going in the same direction. We had a shared vision. So my question for this final segment of our very enlightening conversation is, now that we see that this is really what's required, how do we bring the technology that people like Mark Gerson and Tom Attlee and Jim Ruff and so many other people that and Joan Blades of Living Room Conversations, how do we bring that technology into a general conversation among Americans that shifts the focus from this polarization where we're essentially healthy cells fighting against other healthy cells to where we're pulling together in the same direction?
Well, the biggest idea I've had around that right at the moment is to build something called the American Evolution, which is interesting that you were thinking about that book title with Bruce Lipton as well. And something that it's kind of an idea that's bandied around, that American Evolution is sort of it's like a 2.0 version of the revolution, where we're overthrowing British rule, but now it's actually about coming together to go to the next level as a country. And so I think that what we need to have is a way to consolidate and organize a lot of the inspiration of people who are making those bridges and building. And so you need like an American Evolution TV, and you need tours, and that helps to catalyze more visibility for the living room conversations and for the collaborations at a grassroots level that we instead of the large scale media right now are mainly focused on what's separating us, with some exceptions like Van Jones did a really great piece about bridging with Trump supporters, and there have been some exceptions to it, but I think that we need to have kind of a mass collective awakening and to have that amplified through a shared infrastructure. And so the idea that I've had is to create a new company called AmericanEvolution.us that would be all of the founding shares of it would be donated to a foundation that is for organizations that are protecting and enhancing and reforming our democracy. And so it would be sort of bridging, bringing potential investors in who could help scale this thing, and that is going to be like a real powerful outreach mechanism and infrastructure, because there's all these great initiatives that just don't really have kind of like a shared unifying infrastructure to support it right now. And so that's the idea I've been starting to you know, think about and talk to people about in anticipation of a moment when the zeitgeist is ripe for it. And so I think what we can do right now is we can get engaged and find out about things like living room conversations, or read books like Mark Gerzen's Reunited States of America, which is a great one. And there's a lot of good stuff that's happening in the The Bridge Alliance brings together a lot of different organizations. So it's out there, but what I think we need is to make it more visible and more powerful as a kind of a more of a unified brand and way for it to kind of penetrate into collective consciousness. And then all of the great work helps to kind of go 10x from where it is. So that's my latest idea. I think there are other strategies. You can have political leaders who help to galvanize that, although it's harder to do when the political system is all invested in the two-party warfare right now. But you conceivably, there could be, I think, like a Cory Booker who, you know, somebody who builds a campaign around a kind of a different kind of engagement, for instance. And I think that there could be some things that happen in that arena. But I think it's more likely to be slightly outside of the two-party system that this more unified, uplifting, you know, forward-looking, transpartisan movement arises.
You know, it seems to me that we have a system that can't really reform itself. It's almost as if an intervention is required. Maybe we need to create something called Citizens Anonymous, you know, as a 12-step.
I think that's a great idea.
And do an intervention, because it's kind of like our Uncle Sam has become hopelessly addicted to money. And so many of the positive things that we want to happen, that I think in general people across the political spectrum would like to see a more compassionate, you know, not being involved in wasting our energy on foreign wars and so on. And because of how the conversations have been framed up until now, we are still. Seem to be the news cycle seems to have people stuck in this. Well, I guess I wouldn't call it news. I would call it old. They're stuck in the old form. What you're talking about is similar to what my friend Richard Lang, who wrote a book called Virtual Country that just came out, talks about National Town Square and what he calls an ecosystem of civic engagement. Right now, you know, the Catherine Gale and Robert, I believe his name is Robert Porter, could be Richard Porter, of the Harvard Business School have wrote something called, identified the political industrial complex, which is what we have now, that manages the conversation the way it's been managed. And, you know, people on both sides are making money from, you know, having their, you know, from their ideas being used to fuel one side or the other. So say more about how we bring this new conversation. What do you see the memes? And I think maybe the American Evolution could be one of them. What do you see the memes are for bringing this new conversation into conversations that people are having about politics?
Yeah, well, I think you have to see what gets traction and what doesn't. But I think that what you're very good at, and that you're just doing it there, is naming things in a funny and playful and engaging way, because so much of the energy around our political dynamic is a warfare dynamic, and humor helps to dispel that warfare dynamic and kind of create something that's like goes beyond the two sides. So there's probably a certain amount of humor that's required. I'm not saying all the groups are as adept at it as you are, but it's like there's a way in which if we can laugh a little bit about it, that we can find the pathway to create things that are more unifying. So I think, you know, the things where we really unify have to do with shared purpose. So it's like a, you know, transpartisan, bipartisan commitment to reforming our finance system. I think is, you know, I've started to work with a group in California called the Courage Campaign on a clean money pledge that sort of be like the equivalent of what Grover Norquist was doing with no new taxes, except to focus more on candidates and infrastructure to support candidates who are pledging not to take corporate and large-scale donations. So that would be like one kind of area where reforming, it's like cleaning up our democracy is an area where there's kind of shared purpose. There's also like the human to human contact. We tend to socialize more and more in different orbits. And so having those living room conversations that people like Joan Blades have been involved in activating, I think are really important. So it's the one-on-one humanizing conversations are really important. I also think events are a great way for people to come together. It's like, especially around music and inspiration and some laughter. It's like, that's where I think tours could really be helpful. And then there's the different variations on citizen town halls that we actually harvest more of the intelligence of the community to find shared solutions. So I think it's Carolyn Lukensmeyer has done some interesting innovations on, town halls that are everybody's voting up different proposals. And so there's a number of different folks. I mean, Richard Lang is a good one who's got some software that is helping to support that process. And I think that all of these things, basically it's like you go from the micro, which is individuals, consuming media or reading things that helps to shift their root assumptions and move beyond this. So I think that's where an American Evolution TV could be helpful, or just taking inspiration from some of the bridge building work that's been done out there, people like Van Jones who have really been doing some interesting dialogues. And then that shifts our own internal psychology or reading books, reading articles from left and right. It can be very helpful. And then it's like we take it into dialogical space, like with, a living room conversations, and we take it more into the public sphere through things like town, transpartisan town halls and events, and then all the way to the national level, where I think we really need to have some sort of facilitated process between legislators and people in elected positions that there's a dispelling of some of that tension. And there's been some great work by the Transpartisan Alliance at a national level. I think that could happen at every level, where instead of being locked in this polarized psychology, that there's a really sincere attempt to move beyond that and come up with shared solutions. So I think all of those levels have to happen in parallel, and and we can plug in at whichever level we feel really called. Some people might be a speaker or a humorist or like you, and so you're bringing in a really important grassroots element, and this show itself is a great way to showcase, for the internal process of looking at our assumptions and being aware, where is it that I'm biased and where am I sort of stuck. And when people listen to this show, they're going to be opening their mind and paradigm in different ways. And then, giving talks in different places and having events is a great way for people to meet and find shared common ground as well.
You mentioned Grover Norquist a while back. And yeah, I think it's very important to recognize the power of talking across lines. And, Grover Norquist, who famously said he wants to make government so small he could drown it in a bathtub, after meeting with and being exposed to Bay Area progressives, he totally changed. And now he wants to drown it in a hot tub.
What a great line. What a great line. That's hilarious.
But you see, this is how things change. Because when I did that comedy piece back in 2009 at Joseph McCormick's Transpartisan Citizens Summit, interestingly enough, the people at this event who I made the closest and most heartfelt connection with were the right-wing militia people from Idaho.
Really?
And Yes, and I think it had to do with a sense of a shared willingness to look not just at the light but at the darkness. And I think one of the problems with progressives is that we want things to work out. I'm a Libra. I'm an Enneagram 9. I want to get along with everybody. And I think there's a certain point where it's important to recognize, where the line is, where the boundary is of, the heart of darkness. And I think that one of the reasons why the progressives lost in this last election, or I'd say the Democrats lost in the last election, is over the years and looking at perpetrations like stolen elections, hacked voting machines, et cetera. Some would say assassinations of Kennedys and Martin Luther King, that because the progressives have not really wanted to engage in looking into that heart of darkness with a keen and courageous eye, these perpetrations have gotten worse and worse and worse to the point where now we have, you know, 30% of the people or more believe in a different reality that isn't fact based, and have caused so much let's say disruption of any idea of a shared political reality. So in the minute or 3 minutes we have left, what is the first step in restoring this sense of the sacred, sense of heart and soul in ourselves, in our communities, and in our country?
I think the first step begins with each of us really taking it on as a practice. How can we bring people back into our hearts that we might have cast aside? Who is it that we're demonizing? Who is it that we're attacking? I personally, even though I'm saying that I believe that Trump, a fall from grace is going to be important for him and for our country ultimately to reconnect with our higher purpose. I've had a picture of him on my altar. I send him love and appreciation, and in a way, I feel like he's going to go down historically as somebody who's very reviled, but there's a way in which his soul is playing a kind of a necessary function for evolving our democracy. And so I really want to be in a place where I'm not hating anybody, and that whatever we're hating is a opportunity for practice, and that hate festers and in fact adds fuel to the fire that we're now in. So the practice of really reconnecting with the deeper to see that those who are on the other side have a sacred role to play, even people that we may not normally associate with, and for whatever reason, could be, you know, KKK members. It's like there's a black musician in somewhere in the South that made a point of befriending KKK members, white KKK members, and over the course of his lifetime, is 40 or 50 of them have renounced that. So we have to reconnect with the hearts that have gotten stuck in the darkness. And we also have to be rigorous about exposing everything that needs to be exposed. It's like we can become foolish if we think there are no conspiracies out there, then we're going to be prey to a lot of criminals who are committing them, because there's a reason why conspiracy is part of the criminal code, because people are all the time planning to do dark, deceptive, and destructive things. So we can't see everything as a conspiracy, but we damn well better be awake when there are conspiracies going on too.
Thank you, Stephen Dynan, for this very enlightening interview. I'm holding that about our president, too. Donald Trump had a very rough summer. I'm wishing him a great fall. So anyway, thank you, Stephen. It's been a pleasure. Steve Behrman, WikiPolitiki, and we'll be with you next week.
Thank you.